So, you need to sort of live and die by the website and get the information there. We are going to get right into the material and talk about electroanalytical methods. I'm an analytical chemist by training. And so electrochemistry sort of spans a couple of fields. It spans several fields. It certainly spans the field of physical chemistry and analytical chemistry. Physical chemists make electrochemical cells, and they make measurements, but analytical chemists are interested in making very accurate, very precise measurements and using physical chemical principles in order to make analytical measurements. So some would say analytical chemistry is just applied physical chemistry. And I hope that doesn't make you sick or, you know, anything, but that's all it is. So we're going to talk about electrochemical cells, and I'll mention physical chemical principles. I love physical chemistry, maybe you don't, and so that's okay too. But I just want you to understand that that's where this comes from. Electroanalytical methods can be divided into two areas, two general categories. They're shown here, the potentiometric type systems, which include pH measurements, ion selective electrode measurements, things like that. In that type of a system, it's a very simple electrochemical cell involving two electrodes and a potential measurement or a voltage measurement. The type of cell is in physical chemistry referred to as a galvanic cell because it spontaneously produces a potential. You just hook the thing up and you get a potential reading. And so it says here it produces electricity spontaneously. So that's real simple and easy to use, and we can make some very accurate measurements with that type of system. And again, people use pH measurements, ion selective electrode measurements, they use them all the time, and I'm sure you've done many of these things. We're going to, as analytical chemists, while you're in this room during this hour, hour and a half, or whatever, we are analytical chemists, and we'll talk about how you will use this to make measurements and what the theory is behind all of that, and how to understand exactly what's going on. The idea is this. People make analytical measurements all the time. They also make incorrect analytical measurements all the time. And if we understand how the measurement is made and exactly all of the principles that are involved, then we can make better, more accurate, more precise analytical measurements. And that's my goal as an analytical chemist. I see biochemists, I see polymer chemists, I see organic chemists, I see all different people making analytical measurements. Sometimes they do it right, sometimes they do it wrong. Sometimes they have no idea what's going on. They just said, look, I think you turn this thing on and you stick this electrode in the beaker and the number comes up and that must be the right answer. But it's not all the time if you do the experiment the wrong way or you set up the system the wrong way. So potentiometric measurements, potentiometric systems in analytical chemistry are quite simple, and they're based on this galvanic cell principle in physical chemistry, but people can mess them up pretty easy. The other type of electroanalytical measurement I classify as a voltammetric type measurement or voltammetric systems, and that's based on an electrolytic cell. An electrolytic cell is one that does not spontaneously produce electricity, but you must provide electricity to the system to make something happen. The simplest example that I can give you is plating out a metal onto an electrode surface. So if you have jewelry, people say, okay, or a watch or something like that, you know, gold plated. Oh no, this is solid gold. Okay, well maybe. We could take it down to the lab and find out if it's solid gold, but in the plating process, you use the piece of jewelry as the electrode and you put it into a solution of the ions of the substance that you want to plate out. So it might be gold that you want to plate out or silver that you want to plate out. And you provide power to the system, okay, and you electrolyze, essentially, the solution, and you use the electrode, your piece of jewelry, as one of the electrodes, and you plate out the metal onto the surface of that piece of jewelry, and you get a nice, shiny, beautiful-looking piece of jewelry. Now, that's a simple example, but that is the electrolysis process, and that is how voltammetric systems work, or at least an example of how they work. In analytical chemistry, we can make those kinds of measurements. Now, that's a reduction process where you take an oxidized solution of metal and plate it out, reduce it, okay? Reduce it, make the piece of jewelry the cathode, and perform reduction, and plate out that metal. That's a reduction process. You can also do oxidation processes. I lump them all under this voltammetric system, and we can use that to make very good, precise, accurate analytical measurements also. But it's a different principle. It's a different type of system. It is, as the slide says, it's an electrolytic type cell. It consumes power. It requires you to have a power source, a battery or something, and the measurement is different. Now, I need you to understand that if there's one thing that you've got to learn in the next few weeks is the difference between potentiometric and voltammetric systems. Okay, I want you to understand the difference. I want you to understand that, so I want you to pay attention to those two types of systems, even though they're quite simple. Okay, they're quite simple. All right, we'll talk about potentiometry, and I'll cover it really quick. We're going to be done with potentiometry in a couple of classes, so don't miss it. All right, potentiometry is we're going to determine concentrations by measuring the potential, which is the same thing as the voltage, of an electrochemical cell, which we already said is a galvanic cell. So, potentiometry. You could tear the word apart. You know, the meter is measuring the potential, and you know, that's what we're doing here. And I mentioned already, it's two electrodes. Okay, it's a two electrode system. We have an indicator electrode and a reference electrode, and their names are quite indicative of what they do. Right, the indicator electrode indicates the species of interest. So it says here, potential responds to the activity. Note activity of the species of interest. So it indicates something. It's the electrode that is actually doing the measurement. Okay, it's indicating what's there. The other electrode is the reference electrode. And again, its name is a good name because we're going to reference the measurement to that electrode. Okay, that electrode is not, its potential is not going to change. It's going to be fixed. It's going to, it's chosen, it's set up in such a way that it doesn't change, and our measurements are always referenced to that potential of that electrode. And so it says here, it's independent of the solution composition. So I change solutions, I change concentrations, the reference electrode is always the same, the indicator electrode changes, okay, its potential changes based on the potential that I measure. Difference between the reference electrode, which is always the same, and the indicator electrode, which changes based on the concentration, we're able to determine what concentration we have in the system. So this is how potentiometry works. It's real simple until we get more complicated, okay? This is still simple, right? This is an electrochemical cell like you would see in physical chemistry, right? A little diagram, a little schematic, and there's a beaker. This is supposed to be a beaker, I guess. Okay, and I didn't draw this diagram, but it's a good one. And we have two compartments in the system. Sometimes you have two separate beakers with a salt bridge connecting them. Or in this case, it's all one beaker, but there's a salt bridge in between. Okay, there's a membrane or something separating the two solutions. Now, I'll tell you now that the salt bridge, I wrote that down, is for ion transfer. Okay, the transfer of ions between the two compartments or the two solutions. Then we have two electrodes, a copper electrode, let's see, yeah, okay. We have a copper electrode and a zinc electrode, and they're connected by a wire, a squiggly little wire. And also there is a a device here that's supposed to be the meter that makes the measurement. Okay, kind of crude, I guess. But the idea is, this is a, let's say for example it's a galvanic cell. I haven't really told you what kind of cell it is, but let's say it's a galvanic cell. And we've set it up, we've got our two compartments, we've got our two electrodes, and we have a wire connecting them with a meter, and it shows you that electrons are flowing through the wire. So if electrons are flowing, so this would indicate that maybe it's a galvanic cell, we put it all together, we hook it up, and electrons are flowing in the system. If electrons are flowing, it's a galvanic system, it's spontaneously producing electricity, and electrons, which have negative charges, I know you know all this, are flowing through the wire, and from one side, or from one electrode to the other. Now, if negative charges are flowing, then we've got a problem. We're going to have a buildup of negative charges unless we move some positive charges or negative charges, however you want to look at it. So we can move some negative charges. If negative charges, electrons with little negative charges on them, are going this way, okay, then maybe we need to move some negative charges this way. And I told you that the salt bridge is for ion transport, so we may have negative charges moving this way, or we might have positive charges moving this way, but that's what our salt bridge does, and this is how the system works. It's set up here with a cathode and an anode. Let me tell you what I tell the undergraduates. Reduction takes place at the cathode, and you can remember that because it's a red cat. I don't know, maybe I've never seen a red cat, but a red cat, and the red cat is always on the right. Okay, so if you can remember the red cat is on the right, you'll remember that reduction takes place at the cathode, and by convention, we always put that when we draw these cells and we write reactions and so forth, we typically, I shouldn't say write reactions, when we draw cells or diagrams or schematics, we put the cathode on the right. Okay, this is by convention. So, red cat on the right, that's reduction is taking place. Reduction, of course, another one of those cutesy things, there's Leo Gurr. You know Leo? You know, maybe? I don't know. Leo? Let's call him Leo. If you lose electrons, it's oxidation, right? And if you gain electrons, it's reduction. So, Leo Gurr. So we're losing electrons over here, we're gaining electrons over here, so that makes this the cathode, that makes this the anode. I don't have a cutesy little saying for the anode, but you will remember red cat on the right. Okay, so red cat on the right for the cathode and for reduction. Reduction takes place at the cathode, and Leo, lose electrons, gain electrons. That's how we know the difference, or that's the definition, I guess, of oxidation and reduction. And so what's going on here in this particular system? Well, again, we typically write these things as reductions. Did I say that? I don't know if I told you that, but we typically, when we write electrochemical reactions, we write them as reductions. We write half cells. We talk about what's going on in the zinc compartment over here, what's going on in the copper compartment over here. The entire two compartments makes up the electrochemical cell, but we have two half cells. And I didn't mention to you that zinc sulfate is the solution here in blue, and copper sulfate is the solution over here. In reality, copper sulfate is blue, and zinc sulfate is colorless, but, you know, again, I didn't draw the diagram. And typically, we write these things as reductions, so we would say that zinc 2 plus 2 electrons gives us zinc metal, and sometimes I'll write a little zero there to indicate that there's no valence on the zinc. And then, of course, we would write the copper in the same way. Copper 2 plus 2 electrons yields copper metal. However, based on the way we've set this thing up and the electrons are flowing here, what's actually happening is the zinc is being oxidized, right? Okay, so actually what's going on is, whoops, the zinc, let me cross that out and just say, the zinc metal, all right, is losing electrons and giving us zinc ions plus two electrons. All right, if you can see my, if you can understand or see my handwriting there. So this is two electrons. So I know that because the zinc electrode shows electrons leaving it or going from it. So the zinc metal is actually, so what's actually happening is the zinc is corroding away. So if you were to set up this particular cell and it worked this way, you would see the piece of zinc corroding away, and you would see on the other side over here, you would see, they should have the electrode in here, bright shiny copper plating out over over here, okay? Again, if electrons are being supplied here, then copper sulfate or copper ions in the solution would be gaining electrons and plating out and becoming copper metal, which would plate out on the electrode surface. Okay, so you probably know all that stuff. This is just by review. Now, what does an analytical chemist do? An analytical chemist doesn't do things this way. They're going to say, one of these systems, one of these half cells has to be my reference. So I set it up, and I'll show you in a few minutes how we do that. We set the system up so that one side would always remain constant, would be our reference, and then we would use the other side, the other half cell, as our indicator side, and we would determine the concentration of the solution, of the species in solution, using this kind of an electrochemical cell. Okay, here's another representation of electrochemical cells, or an electrochemical cell, and it's a little, has some advantages, has electrical conductors, that's our electrodes, right? So I have electrode in here. And then we've got an ionic conductor, that's the solution, although we think of aqueous solutions, but you can make molten metal solutions or all sorts of bizarre things, but most of the time it's going to be a aqueous solution. Could be a non-aqueous solution. That's not that common either. And again, they have it here, cathode or indicator, anode or reference. I put this diagram primarily to show you that there is a meter there. Often it's represented with a V, a voltmeter, but in reality a voltmeter is something that an electrician uses to measure the voltage in your house. Okay, an analytical chemist wouldn't use a voltmeter. A voltmeter is not good enough to make good analytical measurements. It's what you really need is an electrometer. Okay, and what we normally use in the laboratory is an electrometer. In the old days, Michael Faraday, you know, those guys 200 years ago or whatever, they used potentiometers. Also a good device. The problem is potentiometers are slow. Potentiometers can make potential measurements, but they do it based on a null or a bridge type circuit. Anybody familiar with the bridge circuit? Wheatstone bridge? Never heard of it. Okay. All that is you take a power source, a known power supply, and you take your unknown electrochemical cell, and you set up an electrical circuit that balances the two. Okay, so I balance the two against each other until all current stops, all current flow, no flow of electrons in the system, and now I know that my unknown electrochemical cell has the exact same potential as my power source. And we can play some games with resistors in the circuit, and we can make the measurement very accurately. And so Faraday and those that developed early electrochemistry were able to make good measurements and develop good theory with very crude instrumentation. We don't want to use that anymore because a potentiometer might take several minutes for us to make a simple potential measurement. And by that time, I could drive through the Burger King, get a Big Mac or whatever they sell there, and get a pizza or something. And so we're in a hurry today, right? So we use electrometers, okay? And an electrometer is a voltmeter. We don't use voltmeter. That's a special voltmeter. It's a high input impedance voltmeter, and it says so right here on the slide. So The way that an electrometer works is it has an extremely high input impedance, says here one greater than 100 mega ohms, and that prevents current from flowing through the meter. The problem with the voltmeter that the electrician uses is that some current will flow through it. If I connect it to my electrochemical cell, some of the current will flow through the voltmeter and change the circuit, change the cell potential. And so I need a measurement device that will not change the cell potential, but will maintain it intact so I can use it. I can use that potential to determine the concentrations. An electrometer is the device. It has such a high input impedance or resistance, a resistance to the flow of electrons in the circuit, that it does not appreciably affect the flow of electrons in the electrochemical circuit, in the cell. And therefore, we get an accurate reading. So the laboratory pH meter, it's actually an electrometer. When you're measuring pH, when you're measuring ion selective electrode, any kind of potentiometry, you are using that voltmeter, that laboratory millivolt meter, as a device that has a high input impedance for making an accurate measurement in your system. Okay, the cell potential, as I've already indicated, this is all really pretty basic stuff. I'm adding a few things as we go along that may build on the basics. But the cell potential, the voltage that we measure in the system, is defined by this equation, or at least this part of this equation here. E for the cell is E for the indicator minus E for the reference, okay? Or it could be, if we did it the way, I won't get into that right now. Indicator minus reference, that's the standard convention by which we do this. So we have two half cells. We've got to take the potential of each half cell and take the difference between them, or in this case, subtract them. So subtract the indicator minus the reference to get the overall cell potential. Now, there's a problem, and that problem is called junction potential. And it's defined here for you, just so that you know, we don't live in a perfect world, okay? There is a problem here. There's another potential that can cause problems. Actually, there are probably a couple of other potentials, but we'll talk about the junction potential right now. It says here, junction potentials develop at the interface between two dissimilar solutions. In reality, junction potentials develop at every junction. Okay, at every, even when you take two pieces of wire and twist them together, okay, there's contact between them, but that's a junction, and there's actually a junction potential that develops there. The thing is that when you take two pieces of wire and twist them together, the junction potential is so tiny that it's insignificant. And it makes no difference whatsoever. However, when I have solutions, right, when I have a reference electrode that has a solution and a test solution that I'm trying to measure, and they're not the same, they're dissimilar, then I have a junction potential that develops. So I have this non-ideal potential that develops. Now, the reason I defined it this way, and this is the classical definition that you will find, is that that's the only significant junction potential when you have two dissimilar solutions. So in the previous slide, when we had a little electrochemical cell, we had a zinc solution and a copper solution. Well, they're not the same, okay? And then we had a salt bridge, and the salt bridge in some electrodes is a solution. And so we got junction potentials that develop because those solutions are not exactly the same. They're not similar, even. They're quite different. And so they give a little bit of a junction potential. So to be technically correct, we say that the cell potential that we measure actually includes the indicator potential, half cell, the reference half cell potential, and then junction potential. Typically, we don't measure the junction potential. What we do is we take steps to minimize it, okay, to make it small. We make the solution similar if we can. Or we use a set of standards and make the standard measurements and the unknown measurements under the exact same conditions. Therefore, the junction potential is the same in both experiments, and it drops out. Right? If I'm making my standard measurements under the same conditions as my unknown measurements, then I can sort of subtract the junction potential out of both of those, and it goes away magically. So we don't typically measure the junction potential, but we should know that it's there. We should know that it's there so that we can minimize it. And one way to minimize it, I'll give you an example. When the problem of acid rain first became widely understood, people went out to collect rainwater samples, and then they stuck a pH electrode in it, and they got erroneous readings, because rainwater is very dilute and has very little ion content in it. To remember, we said we have to have an ionic conductor, okay? And they were calibrating their pH electrodes in buffer solutions that were like 0.1 molar ionic strength, and then they went to zero ionic strength, or, you know, rainwater might have 0.0005 molar ionic strength. So there are a couple of orders of magnitude difference in ionic strength between the buffers that they were calibrating the pH electrode with and the rainwater that they were measuring the pH of. And the measurements were quite wrong, okay, because the junction potential was very high in those systems. Now, turns out rainwater is so dilute that you really, it doesn't have enough ionic conductor in it to make a good measurement. And so most acid rain measurements are not made by pH electrodes. They're made in other ways, not covered in this course. Chromatography, usually ion chromatography, is one of the key ways of doing it. But the idea, the concept is there. You can understand that. Rainwater, very low ionic strength. Buffer solutions, pretty high ionic strength. Big difference in junction potential. So you've got to be careful. If I was going to make pH measurements of a dilute solution, I would use dilute buffers to calibrate. If I was going to use, I was going to make seawater, you go out to seawater, what's the concentration of seawater? You know, it's 0.5 molar sodium chloride, roughly. Okay, so that's a very high, fairly high ionic strength system, and so you would want to calibrate your electrodes and use buffers that had ionic strength similar to that. All right. So these are considerations. All right. Then there's our friend, the Nernst equation. The Nernst equation is our friend. This we saw already. Okay. How do I get these potentials here? Okay. These half cell potentials. I use the Nernst equation. Okay. So I can use the Nernst equation to get the potential of the indicator and the potential of the reference. Right? And then I combine the two in order to get the overall cell potential for my electrochemical cell. So this is basic potentiometry, nothing too complicated. Again, we're building a little bit. I'm reviewing. I'm trying to make sure everybody's got a good fundamental understanding of all this, and we ramp our way up into more complicated topics. But the Nernst equation, quite simple, says that the potential of the system, the half cell, is equal to, and then it gives you an E0, so there's a standard potential. So if we're talking copper, as we were a minute ago with copper sulfate and so forth, there is an E0 for the copper metal, copper ion system. All right, copper, let's see, if we do it as a reduction, it's copper ion, Cu2 plus going to Cu0, Cu metal. And the E0 for that is like 0.77 or something. You don't have to memorize those, okay? You look it up on a table of standard reduction potentials. Again, by convention, all the electrochemists got together, they had a convention, and they said, what are we going to do? Oh, we're going to make them all reductions. Okay, all right. All in favor, say aye. Aye. The ayes have it. Carried, okay? And they had a convention, and they said, we're going to write them all as reductions, okay? We're going to write them as reductions. We're going to put them in table. Now, they had that convention. When I was a undergraduate, we always talked about oxidation potentials. They don't talk about those anymore, all right? They changed it. They had another convention, they changed it all to reduction potentials. So they used to have tables of oxidation potentials. Now it's all reduction, everything's reduction. So you look them up in a book and you'll find they're all written as reductions and the standard potentials are given there, E0. Okay, so under standard conditions, right? 1 atmosphere of pressure, 25 degrees C, etc., infinite dilution, then we have a value for the E0 for the half cell. In the equation also is the gas constant, R, absolute temperature, degrees Kelvin, so it's, you know, 25 degrees plus 273, 298. If you're talking 25 degrees C, then it's 298 degrees K. We have N for the number of electrons. So in the copper case, it's 2 electrons. There are a lot of 1-electron systems. There are a lot of 2-electron systems. There are some 3-electron systems. There's a couple of 4-electron systems. That's as high as I can count. Okay, I don't know of any 5-electron systems, but probably are in organic chemistry. Inorganic systems, which I tend to work more in inorganic systems, 4 electrons, you know, thorium, there's a couple of them. But you could have more in an organic chemistry polymer type system. Anyway, N is the number of electrons, and F is the Faraday. Faraday's constant is like, you know, 96,500. Coulombs, it's the charge on an electron. Coulombs per mole, it's the charge on a mole of electrons. All right. So it's 96,500 coulombs per mole. It's constant. N is going to be a constant for your system. The T is going to be a constant for the conditions under which you're operating. R is the gas constant. So this whole thing is a constant right here. This little portion of the equation is a constant. And then we have natural log of red over ox. Okay. We can convert this to base 10 log if you want to. 2.303 times base log gives you natural log. I'm reminding you of these things, okay? Because you'll forget and make a mistake. And then in the far right-hand side of this equation, we have this little factor, and that it would be technically the activity of the reduced form of the species divided by the activity of the oxidized form. All right. So what have we been talking about? We've been talking about things like copper, right? So I said we have to write it as a reduction. So it's Cu2 plus plus 2 electrons gives us Cu0, right? And so if I was going to do this for the copper half cell, then I would say, okay, the reduced form of it is Cu0. Can I talk about the activity of a metal? Okay, well, not really, because it's a phase unto itself. And so we, by definition or by convention or however you like to think of it, we would represent the activity of a metal or a solid substance as 1. All right, so 1 would go here. Oops. And then we would look for the oxidized form. Well, that's the copper, and that's the thing that has a concentration, right? We have a concentration of copper sulfate in our electrochemical cell that I showed you before, and so that would plug in here. So what's interesting about this is this is going to be 1. We have natural log. We have all of this stuff is a constant. E0 is going to be constant. So all this stuff is pretty much a constant, and we find out that in this particular case, as written as a reduction, the E for this particular half cell, the one that was the copper 2 plus plus 2 electrons yields Cu0, okay? For that half cell, it's the potential is inversely proportional to the activity of the copper ion concentration. And if copper ion activity inversely proportional, the E is inversely proportional to the copper ion activity. So, therefore, based on our buddy Nernst, we can determine the concentration of copper in a system if we set up the copper half cell with a reference where we know the potential of that other half cell, and we can determine copper concentration. And that's what analytical chemists want to do. They want to determine concentrations typically. All right? So I would do that for each half cell. All right? And that gives us our entire cell. Now, you say, well, it doesn't tell us our junction potential. You're right. It doesn't tell us our junction potential. Again, we would minimize that and hope that it's not a major contributing factor in the system, or we would just calibrate it out. Yep.
How do you know about the activity of copper ion?
You don't need to know. You're going to measure that. You're going to measure E. Okay, so in the electrochemical cell, I'm going to make a reference electrode that I do know the concentration, or I do know its potential, and so that's going to go here. And then I'm going to use the copper as my indicator side. Then I'm going to plug that in here. I don't know this. I measure the potential of the cell, and I calculate this. Okay, I calculate that from the Nernst equation. All right, so D equations can be a little cumbersome and easy to make mistakes with, but it's a pretty basic concept. All right, we need to talk about reference electrodes. And the way we, we'll talk about reference electrodes. Yeah, that'll consume our time. And we're going to talk about three kinds of reference electrodes. I'm going to tell you about the three kinds of reference electrodes, and that will give you 90 to 95% of everything that's commonly used by chemists. There are other reference electrodes. Technically, you could use any half cell and set it up as a reference electrode, as long as you can set it up in such a way that you know the potential of that system, it then becomes a reference electrode. Now, back in the old days, they used the normal hydrogen electrode. And you said, well, this is modern times. Yeah, but this is important. Okay, this is important historically. I'll throw a little history in as we go. So it's important historically. You could use the normal hydrogen electrode today, but nobody wants to bother with it. It's too much trouble. You got to use hydrogen. It's explosive. You might have to have a tank of hydrogen. In the old days, again, zip back 200 years ago or something, they could make hydrogen quite easily. It takes some acid, some metal like zinc or something, and you throw the two of them together and bubbles out hydrogen. So they didn't know it. Couldn't call up, Fisher Scientific or whatever and order these chemicals. They had to work with what they had, and they were able to get metals. And they were able to get acid, and so they could make hydrogen. So they made their own hydrogen, and they could get a piece of platinum, all right, and they could make a hydrogen electrode. The normal hydrogen electrode was the common electrode that was used in all early electrochemistry, but again, we don't bother with it today because it's trouble. It's a little bit of trouble. So here's a cute diagram of the hydrogen electrode, and they've got a so this is the half cell for hydrogen, and it's written out for you here, again written as a reduction, two hydrogen ions in aqueous solution plus two electrons yields H2 gas. The system has built into it, I didn't mean to do that, it has hydrogen gas bubbling in, okay, over a piece of platinum. This is platinum, and it says platinum here. You say, why is it black? Well, platinum black is the thing that electrochemists like to use. And it gave a uniform surface, okay? It gave a uniform reproducible surface. So they bubble hydrogen over that surface. It's in contact with hydrogen ions in this. It happens to be nitric acid solution. The nitrate has no use in the system, but it's got to be there as a counter ion to the hydrogen. And so we've got a hydrogen electrode. This half cell then is connected by a salt bridge to another half cell, and away we go. But that is a reference electrode. And again, you could make this in the laboratory today. Get a tank of hydrogen, bubble some hydrogen gas, get a piece of platinum, connect a wire to it, put it into a solution of acid, any acid, and you've got an electrode. Now, let's see. Oh, I'm skipping ahead. Let me just say to you that the normal hydrogen electrode would use some concentration like one molar acid, for example, and we would use atmospheric pressure, right? We would do this under atmospheric pressure. We'd have one atmosphere of hydrogen being bubbled into the system, or some partial pressure of hydrogen. Okay, you could put that in there, and then we would solve the Nernst equation. How would we solve the Nernst equation here? Well, it written as a reduction here, so the reduced form is the hydrogen gas, so we'd have to put the partial pressure of hydrogen in there for the reduced species, and it could be, like I said, you could have an atmosphere of hydrogen, or you could have some partial pressure of hydrogen in that equation, and then you would have the concentration of the acid, all right, as the oxidized species, and all your other constants. Now, what's the, I don't know if I told you, it doesn't say it here, E0 for hydrogen is 0.00 volts. Oh, isn't that amazing? It came out exactly zero. No, they had the convention again. They said, well, we got to start somewhere. Okay, let's start at zero, all right? And so they said, we're going to make hydrogen zero, and everything else is going to be reference to that. So you can see that even though we don't use a hydrogen electrode today, it's still pretty important. It's still pretty important to us because that's the basis of the entire scale by which we measure the potential of everything else. So, normal hydrogen electrode, NHE, is sometimes referred to. Very important, not utilized at all. Okay, E0 has 0 volts, and we'll move on. I said I was going to show you three. So the second one is the calomel electrode. Okay, the calomel electrode, or sometimes the saturated calomel electrode, SCE. When I was a graduate student, undergraduate, this is all we used. We used a saturated calomel electrode, and that was the very easily produced, easily made, very reliable electrode that we used for all electrochemistry. So your pH electrodes, you always had a calomel electrode with them, and so forth. So calomel is HG2Cl2, kind of an unusual substance because mercury forms a dimer. Okay, mercury ions form a dimer, mercury 1, so it's really an HG plus, and another HG plus together makes HG2 plus. And calomel is a mercurous chloride, so it's HG2Cl2, and the half reaction is written here, and it's written again as a reduction. There's the reaction, all right, and it has an E0 of zero positive 0.242 volts. Mercury is involved. People don't like mercury. Mercury's getting such a bad reputation these days, okay? And so people don't like mercury, so they've phased out calomel electrodes pretty much. Now, you probably could still buy one, but the truth of the matter is they're not very popular anymore. And so most have gone on to the third one that I'm going to show you in just a minute, but you'll still find them around. You'll still find them in this building. You'll still look in drawers, and there's a calomel electrode. And people still use mercury. And as bad as mercury is, the lights all have mercury in them. Okay, and people are throwing them out in the trash, and they're breaking open, and mercury's going everywhere. They replaced all of the little thermometers, you know, that you use at home, the electronic thermometers or alcohol thermometers or whatever. And even in the labs, we don't let the freshmen use mercury thermometers anymore. Because they're always breaking stuff. And anyway, so mercury is out. But calomel is still a good reference electrode, and you may still have one, you may still want to use one, you may still be able to obtain one. Again, the mercury, the reduction process, it's HG2+ is the ion. Even though it's an insoluble compound, we know that that's the ionic form of the mercury. And we add 2 electrons to that, and we get 2 mercury metal atoms produced. The chloride in this system is basically preserved, chloride, two chloride ions, okay? But in the, on the left-hand side, it's in the form of the insoluble mercurous chloride. On the right-hand side, it is chloride ion in the system. So when we make this electrode, here's two pictures of the calomel electrode, two different representations, schematic, both of them really. And actually, I have an electrode I brought in, and I'm sure you've seen them. But and this, I'm not really even sure if that's calomel in there. The next electrode I'm going to tell you is it's almost the same. So I'll hand that around in just a minute. But the idea is we've got an electrical connection to the top. We got something called a bung. That's just the red thing on the top of the electrode, okay, that holds the wire and connects it to the rest of the body of the electrode. Inside, there is a glass tube. That glass tube has a platinum wire inside of it. So we got a glass tube, platinum wire, and an outer tube. Actually, this is the inner tube, and this is the outer tube. And then there's a little bit of mercury in there, so when you get to look at this one, you'll see that there's a little blob of mercury in there. Now, the mercury turns out to be a really easy way to connect the wires to each other. You just put some mercury in there and stick the wire into the mercury, and they're connected electrically. But we need mercury in our system because mercury, mercurous chloride, or mercury 1 chloride, I think is the way they teach the freshmen these days. Mercury 1 chloride must be in intimate contact with the mercury in order for this reaction, right? This has to be in contact with this because they're interconverting one to the other. And so in this electrode, mercury is in contact with mercury 1 chloride. Now that's all inside of this inner tube, right? And then it says there's a porous plug at the bottom. So it's got to be connected. The porous plug is a type of salt bridge in a sense, and it connects this inner tube with the outer filling solution. And the outer filling solution, I wrote in here, saturated KCl. If it's an SCE, if it's a saturated calomel electrode, it is a solution that is saturated with KCl. You get potassium chloride has a solubility in the 4 molar range. So if you take, if you make up a solution of 4 molar potassium chloride, you begin to see crystals forming, and you get above 4 molar, somewhere above, slightly above 4 molar potassium chloride, and you have crystals of potassium chloride. Now this is going to be important because if the temperature stays the same, then if I have a solution, as is shown inside of this electrode, sorry, right here, okay, and then in the bottom of the electrode, there's some crystals right there. See those crystals? Okay, those are crystals of potassium chloride. If I add water, a little bit of, if anything happens into that solution, right, it'll remain saturated because there's crystals in the bottom. They'll dissolve to keep this concentration up. If water evaporates, or if something is, potassium is added, or chloride is added, or whatever, things can precipitate out. But the solution will always stay at the same concentration, assuming we have the same temperature. Right? So the chloride concentration is absolutely fixed. It can't change because it's a saturated solution of potassium chloride. Right? If I, like I said, if I add a little water, if I add a little potassium, chloride, whatever, it's always going to stay the same because the saturation concentration of potassium chloride is constant. So, and again, let me remind you that we want to use this as a reference electrode, right? We want to use this as a reference, as an electrode that keeps its potential absolutely constant. Well, if we were to use the Nernst equation and put reduced things over oxidized things, activity and so forth, this is a solid, activity of one. This is a solid, insoluble mercurous chloride. There is, the only thing that's varying in the system is the, that could vary in the system is the chloride content, chloride concentration, and we've fixed it because we're tricky chemists and we put saturated potassium chloride in the electrode, and it's going to stay constant. the chloride concentration is going to stay constant. So, are you saturated, KCl? I've got some potassium chloride crystals in the bottom, and then I've got a contact, a porous plug, which is my junction to the outside world, or to the beaker, the solution of test material. My sample of seawater, or my sample of whatever it happens to be that somebody brought me to measure the pH of, or measure, make some potentiometric measurement, I stick my electrode into that solution, okay? My porous plug, my porous junction, allows contact between the test solution and the half cell that is now my reference half cell, and then all this chemistry is going on in here, which we know is this chemistry right here, okay? That's all going on inside of there, but because it's saturated potassium chloride, the chloride content is fixed, the E for that half cell, based on the E0 RT over NF, natural log of, and so forth, it's all the same. It's all fixed. It's all constant. Never changes. All right? And so, by virtue of this description of the Calomel electrode, I'm helping you understand this is how reference electrodes work. Everybody pretty clear on that? Heard this all before. Nothing to it. Okay, so this is the same thing over here. Same idea, different picture. Now, I told you we were real tricky because we used saturated potassium chloride, around 4 molar potassium chloride. Should be crystals in the bottom if it's saturated. There's a great company in Massachusetts called, I think they're called Thermo Orion Research now, and they make electrodes, a lot of electrodes, and they don't use saturated potassium chloride. They use 4 molar. 4 molar, I mentioned that the saturation point is just above 4 molar, so they say, well, we'll just use 4 molar. That way we won't have all these crystals in the bottom, and we won't have a mess on our hands, and the electrodes won't get all gummed up with crystals, and we'll be pretty close to saturation, and everything will be okay. And sure enough, it is. So when you buy reference electrode filling solution from Orion Research, I don't know why you would buy it. You could make it yourself. You get 4 molar. They'll tell you right on there. It's 4 molar potassium chloride. And it's not actually quite saturation, but 4 molar is a pretty big concentration, pretty large concentration. So if my chloride content, if I did the Nernst equation out and put 4 molar in there for the chloride concentration, I would find out that that is so high that even though slight changes are going to occur in my electrode, some of the mercurous chloride is going to be reduced to mercury ions, and some chloride ions are going to be released from that. That those few ions that come about from the conversion of mercurous chloride to mercury and releasing chloride ions is not going to influence the 4 molar very much. Like so little, you can't tell the difference. So Orion Research says, we'll just use 4 molar. Well, then they figured out that, gee, so we don't have to use saturated. We were so clever using saturated potassium chloride, and we don't even need to, because the amount of change that goes on when I make these measurements is so small that I'm producing a few atoms of, or a few ions of chloride, and it changes the concentration so little that I don't even notice any difference in my potential. Even though I'm measuring potential down to plus or minus a tenth of a millivolt in my system, typically, I don't even notice a change. So I can use other concentrations besides saturation. It doesn't have to be saturated. Could be 4 molar. It doesn't have to be 4 molar. Could be 1 molar. Could be 0.1 molar. Okay? As long as I don't have too much reaction going on in here, producing too much chloride or using too much chloride, then I'm not going to have a problem even if I use 0.1 molar KCl. Now, the potential is going to change, right? Because the Nernst equation has in it chloride concentration. Right? Imagine in your mind the Nernst equation, E0, I should have written it out, but E0, RT over NF, natural log of, and then one, we put the right-hand side, it's reduction, so the right-hand side, so it's chlorides in the numerator in this case, and chlorides on top, And it's not going to change much. And as long as I keep it, you know, pretty constant, it'll be okay. But if I use a different concentration, it's going to give me a different E for that reference half cell. Well, that's okay. Right. E for reference changes slightly, okay. Temperature coefficient, you have to be a little bit concerned about, because I catch the biochemists doing this all the time. They're taking stuff out of the refrigerator and they're sticking it in making measurements. It's cold. T is part of the Nernst equation, right? T. All right. So everything has to be either constant temperature, or we got to know what the temperature is, or we've got to compensate for the temperature. But T is important. All right. You do have to be careful about clogging these things up, right? If it dries out, like this one is dry as a bone, there's no filling solution. You pull this down, and you fill it, right? Well, the filling solution is long gone. It gets all clogged up and doesn't work very well. So you need to keep them filled with filling solution, and this can be a problem for this electrode. All right, the last electrode that we're going to talk about is the silver-silver chloride reference electrode. Now, the silver-silver chloride reference electrode, which this one might actually be, because it kind of looks like silver in there. It's the same as the calomel electrode, except we're using silver in the system. We're using the silver chloride, silver-silver chloride system. So it's no longer, silver does not form a dimer, okay? Silver is Ag+, and so it's almost the same, except that we now have all those twos in the equation, okay? So it's AgCl plus an electron gives us silver metal plus a single chloride ion instead of Hg2Cl2 and two electrons and Hg, two Hgs and two Cls. It's all one of everything. But other than that, it's kind of the same thing. It's pretty much the same. The E0 is different. It's 0.222 volts, I believe. Again, look that up, probably. E, not E0, but E changes if you use one molar KCl instead of saturated KCl. And so the E I have here for one molar is 0.228, maybe. I think I did these calculations some time ago. And you can make these things in the lab. Now, you can see how simple this thing is. Let me pass this one around. You can have this one. This is obviously commercially made. But you can make a silver chloride electrode quite easily. What we do is you can buy a porous frit, a piece of Vicor glass, which all that is borosilicate glass where they etch out the boron. So they make borosilicate glass, and then they etch out the boron, and it leaves little channels or holes through the piece of glass. So now I've got a piece of glass, a little frit, okay, that's porous. And therefore, solution is going to work its way in and out of here, so I have a salt bridge. I have a means by which ions can be transported. Inside is my solution, which is KCl, okay? I have a silver wire, okay, coming into the solution. And on the surface of the silver wire, this little gummy stuff that I put on there, I drew this one myself, yes, thank you very much. I'll keep my day job. Is silver, is amorphous silver metal. Got to have silver metal, right? Here it is. Okay, so, excuse me, I said that wrong. The wire is made of silver metal. The amorphous material on the surface is silver chloride. How do you put silver chloride on the surface? You can anodize the piece of wire. I make it the anode of an electrochemical cell. I stick it in some silver chloride, and chloride ions plate out in sort of a monolayer on the surface of the electrode. Okay, and so now I have this, and this was what I was trying to get at here, is a silver chloride coating on the silver wire. So I've got a little funky coating on the end of my piece of silver. And I put a little stopper in the top, and that's all there is to it. Okay, it's a piece of glass connected to the porous frit. I use heat-shrinkable Teflon to connect the little porous junction frit at the end, put the Teflon on there, put it over a hair dryer, you know. Blow dry my hair first, then I use the hair dryer to shrink the Teflon to hold the porous junction to the glass body. put some KCl in there, stick the silver wire in there. First, I'd maybe anodize the silver wire in a chloride solution, then I put it in there, put a stopper in the top, and I've got myself a little electrode. And I used to manufacture these, you know, doing electrochemistry. I'd make five or six of them at a time. So I'd get, you know, cut little pieces of glass and fire polish them and get out the little pieces of Vicor that I bought and heat shrinkable Teflon and put them all together and put the solutions together, set them all up, and then let them equilibrate overnight or whatever, and then I have a bunch of electrodes for my use for electrochemistry. Everybody wants to use silver today because it's non-toxic compared to calomel, which has mercury in it, so that's fine. It's also a very reliable system. In the old days, silver was a precious metal, so they didn't want to use silver. But now they don't want to use mercury. They don't care what silver costs, so that's fine. And we have a very simple system. Silver chloride reference electrode. We've seen that. Let's see. I think this is a cute little animation. Okay. So we've got the silver wire. We've got silver chloride coating on the wire. We've got potassium chloride in the filling solution, all right? And there's the Nernst equation, all right? And so obviously, written as a reduction, this has an activity of 1. This also, all we got to worry about is chloride, all right? And in terms of oxidized things, there's nothing, so we end up with just 1 down here. Everything else, so all of this is constant. And E, for this half cell, is directly proportional or is related to the chloride content, chloride ion activity. If I keep that fixed, I get a constant potential for this half cell and I can use it as a reference, all right? So everybody goes out and uses pH electrodes. You say, I don't use a reference electrode when I make pH measurements. Oh, yes, you do. It's a combination, right? The electrode has both a pH electrode in it and it has a reference, a silver chloride reference in it. We'll talk more about that as we go along. We'll talk about the pH electrode, but I want to get the reference electrodes out of the way today. So we've talked about the three kinds. Now, people who do corrosion measurements sometimes use other types of reference electrodes. Again, I said before, you could make reference electrodes out of almost any half cell as long as you keep the chemistry constant in order to keep the potential constant. Keep the chemistry constant, keep the potential constant. All right, so we have, by way of review, the normal hydrogen electrode, its name and its equation, so you should be able to know the chemical reaction. And saturated calomel electrode and silver chloride, and they're all pretty simple. Now, the next part of my discussion is going to be indicator electrodes. Right, we did the reference electrodes. Now we got to make an indicator electrode. So, in this little diagram, I got a voltmeter, which is really an electrometer. I've got a reference electrode, which is going to be normal hydrogen. Too clumsy, too dangerous with the hydrogen. Calomel, I don't want to work with mercury. Okay, it's silver, all right? It's a silver chloride electrode. And so I've got a silver chloride reference electrode in here. And then I've got a sensing, or what I call the indicator electrode. Again, indicator electrode indicates activity of the species. Some places you'll see it listed as a working electrode or a sensing electrode. I don't like the term working electrode because it's a lazy electrode. It doesn't work at all. Okay, it just sits there and indicates, all right? But I'm going to reserve the term working electrode for voltammetry, where the electrode is actually doing something, where the electrode is acting as a source or a sink for electrons, and it's either doing oxidation or reduction, and there's an active process taking place, whereas in the potentiometric system, it just kind of sits there, and the system spontaneously produces a voltage, which then, using the Nernst equation, indicates to us what the concentration is in the particular system. In indicator electrodes, You're not anxious to leave, are you? This is such good stuff. I mean, I'm so excited about electrochemistry and all this good information. And you don't want to get, I wouldn't want to gyp you, you know, your money's worth from this class. So let me just say to you that indicator electrodes, we're going to talk about metallic indicator electrodes first. We're going to call them the electrodes of the first kind, and they're active metals. Silver works as an active metal, so we've talked about silver a little bit. Copper, mercury, lead, cadmium, those metals. When I was in physical chemistry lab as an undergraduate, they gave me a bar of cadmium. It was about this long, about this big around. Okay, looked like one of those big pretzel sticks that you get. Okay, but you wouldn't want to eat cadmium, although it's soft. It's a soft metal. You could probably chew it. And they gave me this, and they said, "Here, make your electrochemical cell using this bar or this rod of cadmium." And of course, cadmium is highly toxic, and it's probably really bad to handle that. But at any rate, it's an active metal. So you can just take any one of these active metals and other metals and stick it in a solution, okay, and make an electrode of the first kind or a metallic indicator electrode. Now, it's a lousy electrode. It's not a very good electrode, but it does work. It does work. And this reaction that I've shown you here for silver is not the same as the reaction we saw previously. Okay, the other one was silver chloride. Okay, so silver chloride was being reduced to silver metal. Here, silver ion is being reduced to silver metal. Has a different E0. It's a different reaction. Don't get them confused, all right? And it's a very simple system. You can measure high concentrations easily with these kinds of electrodes. It's just a curiosity. I tell you about it just so that you'll know about them. Nernst equation works the same. We can plug all the stuff in. We got a new E0, okay, for this reaction. And of course, the activity of the silver is still 1. So it's here we have the ion, okay, the silver, the oxidized species. So this becomes 1. And this is all constant. And so here we plug in the activity of the silver ion, okay? And I did here for you, I converted it to base 10, and you may be quite familiar with the 0.059. N is equal to 1 in this case, and so again, very simple to do this calculation. I plugged it in for you, 0.799, 1 for N, 1 for the activity of the silver metal, and in this particular case, a silver-silver ion system is inversely proportional. The potential is inversely proportional to the concentration of silver. But it doesn't work real well. Okay? It's a silver-silver ion system as opposed to the silver-silver chloride system. And it